Today's text comes from Romans chapter 8, verse 26 and 27. Paul writes this: "In the same way, the Spirit helps us in our weakness. We do not know what we ought to pray for, but the Spirit himself intercedes for us through wordless groans. And he who searches our hearts knows the mind of the Spirit, because the Spirit intercedes for God's people in accordance with the will of God." Word of the Lord.
Hey, good morning, everybody. How are you? If you're visiting this morning, my name's AJ. I'm one of the pastors here. It's a real joy to have you. If you're noticing, I'm making like tight angles in my turns. Yesterday, I woke up with a pinched nerve in my neck. So not to worry. Elena gave me my essential oil, so I'm good to go. I'm convinced that when Jesus spat on the saliva, that was code for Jesus got out his essential oil and went to town. That's what happened. So it's been a month in the Cheryl home. Let me tell you, Lent has been really working on us. So it's good to be here, though. By the way, St. Cecilia's Sunday night, there's probably a couple tickets left. If you've not been, go. It is amazing. Some of the ways that people in the past talk about like when heaven and earth seem to meet, they're called thin space, right? This idea that it seems like more is here, more is happening, more is available than I really knew before I got here. That's what Sunday nights really feel like for me. And so if that's at all open to you, or you're at all open to that and you want to come this evening, there might be a few tickets left online. And I just want to say, like, Troy and I designed this service. It's sort of like an ancient future feel. It has like old historic practices, but we're longing for the renewal of the Spirit on Sunday nights. And he has just done an incredible job putting this service together, and I'm so grateful for you. You are such a gift. You are such a gift. We're in the third week of a conversation called Deeper Still, which is basically a way of saying, are there deeper pathways of connecting with God than I've previously accessed in my life? Are there sort of modes of prayer that might help me learn to really pray in my life that are a bit deeper than just sort of launching out into whatever I want to talk about for 10 minutes and then getting on with the rest of my day? And so we started 2 weeks ago with this passage in Luke 4 where Jesus is led by the Spirit after his baptism into the wilderness. So you have the baptism of Jesus, you have the Sermon on the Mount, which is like the best teaching ever. And in between, you have these 40 days of wilderness where Jesus is in this sort of like cosmic battle with the enemy. And what I notice is this: Jesus starts his public ministry in the wilderness and faces significant opposition. Let me say that again. Jesus begins his ministry in the wilderness facing opposition. And it's very similar when you think about it thematically to what's happening in the Genesis narrative, right? Only it's not in paradise, it's in the desert, it's in the wilderness. Now just hang with me here for a second. Let's just back out and imagine the poetry of what's happening here. If the Genesis narrative tells the account that begins in paradise and it leads us into wilderness, the gospel account is the narrative that tells about something beginning in the wilderness and leading us back to paradise. What I want to suggest in beginning this morning is that Jesus has come to reverse the trajectory of a narrative that has led us toward death and is inviting us to life. That so much more is happening in this wilderness narrative when Jesus is led by the Spirit out. Jesus is reversing the trajectory of what had previously happened in Genesis from sort of paradise to wilderness, moving us back from wilderness into the kingdom of God. Now that's beautiful. That's poetry. That's deep spirituality at a good level of imagining that maybe God is up to more in you and me in this world than we previously have thought. So one of the questions we're wrestling with this Lent is, how do we soak up the life that God may be giving? Lent means slowly. How do we slow down to notice? To notice what's working. To notice what's not working. How do we slow down to notice our friends and our spouse? or to notice a sunshine on a cold day, which we got a little bit this week, and that brought me some joy, right? Or to notice our children, or to notice God, or to notice, maybe we slow long enough to notice our heartbeat. When was the last time you actually felt your heart beat? And you thought to yourself, wow, that's still going on. I had no idea. I mean, I sort of had an idea, but I had no idea. I don't stop to check in to see if my heart is still beating. Thanks, God. Thanks for letting that continue to happen, right? So much of joy in life comes from noticing what has been there the whole time, but I've just forgotten to notice it. So last week we talked about two words. We talked about the word noise, and we talked about the word room. And we sort of explored what that meant for a deeper spirituality of noticing all the noise around us. And is there a deeper room that we can go into to access more of the presence of God? And so today we're going to build on two more words and continue our Lenten journey into the heart of prayer. And it's these words. It's the word still and groans. That last week was noise and room, and we move even deeper this morning into still and groans. So let's begin with still. I want you to consider this statement. At the beginning of Jesus' ministry, he is still in the wilderness. I don't have that painting, but last week I had a lot of requests this week for that painting by Ivan Kramskoy, where he's sitting in the wilderness, contemplating, thinking, praying, struggling, connecting with God. That at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, he's still in the wilderness. At the end of his ministry, he's still in the tomb. That what we have is a spirituality Jesus is showing us that it seems to be, if we want to connect these themes and see a wider story, it seems that what if it is true that the pursuit of stillness prepares us to notice more, to encounter more, to see more, to live more, to pray better? What I want to suggest is that what if stillness always comes before the miraculous? What if stillness typically precedes breakthrough? If this was true for Jesus in the wilderness, and this was true for Jesus in the tomb that then experienced resurrection, what if stillness is a deep, robust part of following Jesus that we simply forget to tune into? So one of the questions I would begin with that we'll just kind of weave through is this. In a busy world, do you have a vision for stillness in your life? Because listen, if you don't create it, it will not happen. In a busy world, do you have a vision for slowing down, for noticing, and for stilling before the presence of God? We started this practice in our office a few months ago when Epiphany began back in January, and it was this idea of ringing of the bells, that when the bells ring, they disrupt our work day. And so at 12 and 3 every day at Mars Hill, our staff will hear these bell chimes go off in the offices. And it's a reminder to stop and to notice that the presence of God is here. You can imagine what it's like to be in a 3 o'clock meeting and we're pounding, we're crushing, we're programming, all of these ideas are coming up, and you hear the bell and we just stop. And like not a lot big happens. It's just that reminder. Oh, yeah, that's right. God's here. God's here. What does that mean? How does that change sort of our conversation? How does that change what we're planning, what we're thinking about, what we're praying about, to remind ourselves, oh, yeah. Let's be invited into the reality that God is here. It's this sort of holy disruption. And I find that I have to sort of even program these moments into my day. Otherwise, I'll just rush to and fro and forget to notice. Which brings us to octogenarians and MacBooks. Any octogenarians in the room? The gifts of the room. Any octogenarians? I know we have a few usually at every service. If you're here and you don't want to raise your hand, that's fine too. We're glad you're here. What a gift that you are. A few years ago, one of my professors in my doctorate program is a Franciscan monk, and his name's Richard Rohr. And maybe some of you have read a few of his stuff, and he's a really gifted man. And so 8 of us spent a whole week with him. And before flying out to spend time in New Mexico with this monk, we were told that you can get an additional 2 hours for your program if you'll come to this conference he's leading with this clinical psychologist named James Finley. And so I jump on a plane. I'm like, sure, I'll take a couple more hours to run a program. So I jump on a plane, head out to New Mexico, and I'm sitting at this conference. And they're basically just these two guys sitting on a stage that is just packed. I mean, we're talking 1,000 people, and they're just on a stage. There's no, like, instruments, there's no fog, there's nothing interesting happening, but two guys sitting on a stage gushing wisdom, and the place is absolutely packed. And I get there late, and I find myself to the one chair that's available in the room, and I pull out my MacBook, and I begin to furiously type, because I'm noticing the morsels of wisdom dropping from their mouths are really, really beautiful. And so I'm just trying to capture it all. And it's just like peck, 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 just getting it all down. And all of a sudden, I get this finger right on my shoulder. And it's just a bony finger. I can tell that's a bony finger happening right now. And it's just like pecking right at me. And so I turn around and I'm like, hello, ma'am. And she looks at me. Oh, she was so kind, but so sincere and full of the wrath. She looked at me and she just said, hey, listen, you're distracting me. I'm so sorry. What's going on? She said, would you please put your computer away? I can hear you type. Sure. If that would be helpful. I don't mind a bit. So I put it away. And I looked around. And I noticed it was me and 1,000 octogenarians. 1,000 of them. They were all gathered to this space in this time for this conversation. And I'm looking around thinking, why do I feel so young? Why am I the youngest guy in the room and I'm the only one with a MacBook who's heard of Apple, right? Like having these conversations in my head. And so during lunch, I'm sort of going around from like group to group and I'm asking this question, why are you here? What brought you to this place? And person after person after person said like all of these same sort of threads, these streams, these sort of themes that kept coming up. And it came down to this. I concluded that they were all there because they were craving for spiritual intimacy. They were craving it. Like their cynicism had stripped away. They weren't in like doctrinal competitions anymore. They weren't trying to sort it all out. They had come to a place. And I think this happens. I think eventually we come to our place in our walk with God where you've heard it all. You've heard all the arguments. You've heard all the doctrine. You've done it all. You've climbed all the mountains. And you conclude this. I think we come to a place where we conclude that wholeness and joy and identity is not achieved somewhere out there, but rather it's waiting to be accessed somewhere in here. That we're not missing life because we lack more information, usually. That God, wherever we are, is mysteriously present, is radically available. And I don't know a lot, but I know this. More information is never an adequate substitute for spiritual intimacy. And all the fives on the Enneagram just said, whoa. More information is never an adequate substitute for spiritual intimacy. This week I felt just this prompting of God whisper into my heart something like this. Hey, AJ, you can spend all your time trying to know everything, or you can spend time with me. And I'll teach you everything you ever need to know. Super convicted that what if that's true? Brings us back to the question, in a busy world, do you have a vision for stillness in your life? Do you have a vision for that? Because it's not just going to happen. We must create that space where we can notice God more. There are 4 primary directions for prayer. You know them. First is talking at God, right? This happens a lot when we're teaching kids how to pray, right? This is prayers at bedtime. When you're sort of launching prayers up to God, it's really beautiful. It's really helpful. Kids learn to pray. It's the basic building blocks of prayer. And then talking to God, right? Talking to God is this idea we begin over time to develop a sort of conversational tone. This is the one that's most present in the church. When we sing to God, when we're talking to God, when we're sort of just talking out loud with God, or we're praying in our minds with God, right? And then you have this one of listening to God as another form of prayer, where it's more silent, right? But you're still longing for a word or a vision or an impression or wisdom or clarity. But there's a sense of listening at this point. A lot of the charismatics help us learn this, of like seeking God God in terms of like my next steps. I want to listen to know, where are you moving me next and what are you leading me into? Would you give me an impression, a direction? And the last is this, of being with God. And being with God is really what we're talking about in this series, this idea of deeper, deeper still. Being with God is this mode of stillness with, where we simply rest in the presence, where it's not wrong to long for wisdom and vision and impressions and direction. It's not wrong to talk with God or at God, but we can move even deeper, deeper, deeper into the inner room of our heart, and it's enough to be with God. And I think what we find is that time and again, Jesus was sneaking away for stillness and solitude and silence. Look at these scriptures. When I think about Jesus spending 40 days in the wilderness, you know at some point it wasn't just full of him talking all the time. We just run out of things to say. But there had to be many moments where Jesus is just being with God. And so somehow that's bringing a sort of presence and calm and understanding into his life. All of these passages show that this is a biblical practice. This isn't like some sort of like mystical thing that we're leading into ambiguity. That spending time in the presence of God, resting, all of these ways in which Jesus was constantly saying to the crowds, I'm going to bounce, constantly saying to his disciples, I'm going to peace out for a second. I need to spend some time in the presence of the Father and remind myself who I am and what I've come for, because I can only do the things I see him doing. Jesus was constantly sneaking away from the crowds. Anyone remember Mad Men from 2011? It's like golden years. Mad Men just took our culture by storm. And it was a big deal. And a year after it came out, Time Magazine did this feature on Mad Men. And they started noticing dynamics on the set. And so the writer of this article points out this crazy dynamic. She says that on every given set in all the world, in all of Hollywood, in all of New York, in all of, you know, wherever films are being shot, there's always a time for breaks. That actors take breaks, and during their breaks, they smoke cigarettes. Copious and copious amounts of nicotine entering into the body during actors' breaks, right? This was just part of it. You get a cigarette and you have a conversation. And the writer makes this observation after years and years of writing, years and years of being on movie sets. The writer says this about the actors. He says, the actors still take breaks, but the difference is on this set and what I'm seeing now in film is that instead of cigarettes, they now step out to check in on their iPhones. That instead of a line of people smoking, it's a line of people checking in. And the writer makes this suggestion. In essence, they have traded in their addiction to nicotine consumption for data acquisition. That more information is the guiding impulse of our time for self-discovery. So could it be true that more information is never an adequate substitute for spiritual intimacy? Being still, saying, in a busy world, do I have a vision for stillness in my life? Which leads us to the second word, groans. Let's move into the text of Paul. There was a scripture that that I read back when I lived in California many moons ago. I moved to California after living in Orlando and doing ministry there. And it wasn't going well. I'd come out of like a really thriving ministry in Orlando that we started, and it grew, and there was energy. And many of you that were here for the early days of Mars, you know what that felt like. You kind of get swept up into something. Like, I'm not sure what this is, but I'm going with it. The current's beautiful, it's strong, and it seems to be what God is doing. Similar things were happening in Orlando at the same time that Mars was being started. And so I decided to resign from there after a few years and to move out and just plant a church in Southern California. And it wasn't going according to how I thought it would go in terms of the growth and the excitement. In fact, I didn't know anybody, all of these things, right? And maybe that's where you are right now, where life isn't really going to plan. And what I noticed was this: I was striving really hard and praying very little. And when I did pray, I found that my prayer life was bound in like outcomes of like how well this could be achieved and how quickly and getting the things I want. And so I stumble upon this passage that Josh read us to lead us into this day. And it reads this: likewise. By the way, this is one of the craziest passages in all the New Testament. This is like the passage that I think blows our minds and has the potential to take us into a deeper longing. Likewise, the Spirit helps us in our weakness, for we do not know what to pray for as we ought. The Spirit intercedes for us, and here it is, with groanings, too deep for words. And he who searches hearts knows what is the mind of the Spirit, because the Spirit intercedes for the saints according to the will of God. What does that mean? So I hit this passage in the midst of just vocational crisis. And I begin to wonder, like, maybe in the core of this passage, in the revelation of this passage, maybe there's a breakthrough that I've been searching for. I mean, when you look at the we in this, look at the we highlighted here, for we do not. I think what Paul is saying is that there is a we, a part of us that we live in the shallows, we live in the surface, we live within our superficial selves, just trying to like get our daily functions done. And that's not bad. It's just not the whole of who we are. This sort of we part, I think this we sort of gets it, the part of our lives that just gets caught up in the noise. You remember that passage from last week where Jesus says, go and pray in your room. And when the suggestion was last week that that's not just about like architecture, it's about the interior room within yourself that God has called you to pray within, to get deeper and deeper in who you are and to pray from that point, to be aware of your feelings, to be aware of who you are, to be aware of the things you really long for. And this word groanings is this crazy word in the Greek, stenogmoi. And I have been, at this point in California, a Christian for years. And I begin wrestling after reading this passage, like, do I know how to discern the voice of God? Do I actually believe that this is really happening? That God the Spirit is living inside of my chest? Can I take that seriously? And secondly, can I take it seriously that same God is groaning in me? And then I began to ask the question, if that's true, am I even aware of that? Would I even know what that sounded like? Would I know what that felt like? If you're interested in these kinds of things and going deeper into them, Marjorie Thompson wrote a book called Soul Feast. And she writes this. She says, have you considered what an astonishing promise it is that the Spirit prays in us and does so according to the will of God? Perhaps our real task in prayer is to attune ourselves to the conversation already going on deep in our hearts. Then we may align our conscience intentions with the desire of God being expressed at our core. And I think that is it. I think that is the critique on the 21st century, where we are obsessed with information and noise and acquisition and data and more and more. I believe in this text, Paul is saying that we are often so caught up in all of our inner dramas, right? That we don't even know what to pray for. And we just stay at the shallow end of the pool. And that somehow we are lost in our heads. And that the way back to God might actually not be out there, but might actually look more like stillness and silence and solitude. And really, surrender, I think, is what it comes down to. I notice that I connect more with God's will in my life when I'm just willing to take a posture of openness. To say, my prayer with our executive team at our church here, we start our meetings every time the same way with this prayer. God, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know how to lead this church. I don't know where we're going. But you do. So would you show us the way? I mean, what happens in life when our posture moves into openness saying, I'm done with control. I'm done manufacturing results because it's not working. I wonder if groanings could also be translated as longings. Thinking about a Spirit who struggles inside of us, like the way Israel struggled with God, this idea of the Spirit wrestling and being present and struggling with our wills, right? This idea of longing for all things to be made new. I wonder about the Spirit in the midst of all of our crises and tragedies and all of our pain and brokenness and sorrow, if there is this Spirit in us that is present with us, who will not forsake us and leave us, but is committed to wrestling in us for the will of God and the renewal of all things beginning in the core of who we are. who's present in and out of every season, who will cling to us even in our dying breath, and will be the power to bring us back to life in resurrection. Nobody talked about that in my church growing up. And yet I see it plain in this text that God is here. In a busy world, do you have a vision for stillness in your life? I met Cindy DeBoer a few weeks after moving here. I was meeting she and her husband as we closed today. I met about 50 couples my first month or so. And they were one of the couples that was, someone had created a list for me that, oh, you've got to meet these people. They'll show you like who Mars is and help you understand this culture. And I'm meeting with the two of them and just having a beautiful time. And we're meeting over a cup of coffee and the conversation is light and insightful. And then it just got real. And she says to me, yeah, 3 years ago on Thanksgiving Day or the day before Thanksgiving, I was diagnosed with a progressive degenerative disease called Lyme. Happy Thanksgiving. And essentially it cysts on my lungs. And doctors usually on the high side say that you'll have probably 10 years at best to live once the disease sets in. And so here she is, and I realized I'm looking at a woman who's processing the meaning of Lent every day of her life. And really we all are, but it's when you get the diagnosis, it just seems to like be real that from dust we have come and to dust we shall return. And I'm telling a piece of her story, but I want her to come and tell a piece of another story that she writes about in her blog. So if you join me in welcoming Cindy DeBoer as she comes and tells us just a little piece of another story that's gonna help guide us into where we're going, so.
So before I read my blog, I just need to give you a little context of where my life was at the time that I wrote it. My husband Paul and I had agreed that 2016 was the worst year of our lives. We ushered it in with, I had a herniated disc, I was flat on my back. Then my health problems escalated and we had multiple trips to Ann Arbor, medication changes that had terrible side effects. So I had to be put on more medications to deal with those side effects, the worst being insomnia. I feel like I didn't sleep at all for 2016. We had a job change. It was a significant blow to our finances. Paul's mother has Alzheimer's, and my dad has colon cancer. We were both their primary go-to people. We, in the midst of all of that, felt a real strong call from God to move to Grand Rapids out of the suburbs. And we'd been praying about that for years. We knew we were supposed to do it, but and it's been a great thing. It was the right decision, but we bought this piece of crap house that really about killed us. It had killed our finances, our backs, and about killed our marriage. We moved into that piece of crap house before it was done. We didn't have a kitchen. We didn't have a door on the bathroom. It was like camping in a house. And in the midst of all of that, we had two major surgeries. I had one, my 18-year-old daughter had another. Didn't go so well, tough recoveries. And we barely settled into our house when my dad got really sick. Spent about a month getting him into a nursing home. And then 4 weeks later, he died. And 8 weeks after that, Paul's stepdad died. And this was nearing the end of the year. We were so tired, so broken, so spent, so alone. I'm a psychiatric nurse at Pine Rest, and I can't tell you how many times I drove to work, and I couldn't decide if I should drive up to the employee entrance and clock in, or if I should drive up to the patient admitting entrance and admit myself, because I was sure I was more depressed and more broken than any of my patients. And then came Christmas. And that's when I wrote this blog that AJ was referring to. entitled it Screaming into Nothingness. Christmas morning. As our girls tore into their stockings, hung by the chimney with care, the phone rang. It was one of those phone calls that changes everything. From that moment on, life would be divided into two segments, the before the call and the after the call. My 45-year-old sister, who's married and has two teenage kids, had been rushed to the hospital after waking up with right-sided paralysis, vomiting, and a headache. We're a tight family, and without a second thought, we trashed our Christmas plans and bolted up to the hospital as well. And by we, I mean everybody. Grandmas, aunties, uncles, brothers, sisters, kids, and cousins. Someone pointed out that we must have looked like the Bravermans rushing to Zeke's bedside in the final episode of Parenthood. Together, we exited this comfortable and familiar world called normalcy, and we were forced to enter a foreign galaxy called Neurology ICU. Here, no English is spoken. Here, the air is thin and breathing is difficult. Here, minutes are hours and waiting becomes your livelihood. Here, appetites no longer exist. Here, sleep is stolen in 10-minute increments, in chairs, next to strangers who smell as if they haven't showered in days. Here, you don't remember if you've combed your hair, changed your underwear, or brushed your teeth, but also, you don't care. Here, you cry a lot. It's ICU, CT scans, MRI, dilaudid emesis, Norco emesis, hemorrhage, left parietal lobe, MRI, CT scans, PET scans, more ICU surgery, EEG, seizures, MRI. Her final diagnosis, high-grade glioblastoma. It's the worst and fastest-growing brain tumor. Months, maybe a year or two at best to live. Welcome to our newest galaxy, brain cancer. And the common denominator of all of us gathered in this galaxy is we are lost and alone. We are completely lost and alone. None of us know our way around here. None of us know what to say or what to do. None of us know what we want or even what we need. None of us know what questions to ask. None of us can eat. None of us want to go home, and none of us want to stay. And worst of all, none of us can pray. We just don't feel God here. We are told He inhabits this galaxy too, but it doesn't seem possible. There's so much pain and suffering and heartache and anguish here. This feels more like hell. And God cannot inhabit hell, can He? We wail and cry and mourn in this galaxy. It's the only thing that comes naturally. And our cries turned into screams, and we scream into what feels like nothingness. And yet, our phones were lighting up from all the saints, the incarnate Jesus people telling us they were praying for my sister and for all of us, giving us scripture to hold on to, all the things that we could not do. Screaming into nothingness was all we could do, but the Jesus people took it from there. So, let me tell you, if you've ever simply hit like on the Facebook post for a hospitalized person simply to show you're out there, it mattered. If you've ever typed the simple word praying on a care page's post, it mattered. If you've ever dropped off barbecue on the porch of someone going through a crisis because you know they'll eventually need it, it mattered. If you've ever just showed up in the ICU waiting room with a basket full of munchies and a tray full of subs, it mattered. If you've ever simply sat in silence along someone in crisis, knowing your presence was your gift, it mattered. If you've ever awakened in the middle of the night and thought of someone in a crisis and then prayed for them, it mattered. If you've ever felt God supernaturally give you scripture and shared it with someone in crisis, it mattered. If you've ever just hugged someone really hard and really long because the deep pain of the situation left you with no words, it mattered. If you've ever sent a thinking of you card, even a lame, dusty, covered with pink grandma-style peonies that you found in the bottom of your card drawer, it mattered. Because when lost in the galaxy of brain cancer, or lung cancer, or breast cancer, or any cancer for that matter, or the galaxy of divorce, or reactive attachment disorder, or death or job loss, or the rejection of adult children, or Alzheimer's, or heart failure, marriage infidelity, financial ruin, or ALS, or any other crisis that launches you from Earth, you often cannot find your way back. You're truly lost and alone, and you cannot find the words to pray. And the thing is, it's possible you'd stay lost and alone in that galaxy forever, screaming into the nothingness forever, if it weren't for the Jesus people who showed up and stepped up and prayed. In a crisis, the Jesus people aren't praying with you, they are praying for you. And so I wonder if the Holy Spirit speaks through the prayers, the actions, the cards, the hugs, and the barbecue of the Jesus people. And I wonder if that's what Romans 8:26 means, that in the same way the Spirit helps us in our weakness, for we do not know how we ought to pray, but the Spirit himself intercedes for us with groans too deep for words. And so this is where I sit today, still very broken, very tired, we're spent, and we still feel alone. It's been pain upon pain upon pain and grief upon grief. My husband Paul and I were often even embarrassed of how much sorrow we've experienced and feel like people kind of roll their eyes when they see us coming, like, oh, here come the divorce, wonder what sad story they have now. And I don't even know how, but somehow, here I am, and I'm still standing, and I get out of bed each day, and I'm daily praying for my sister and everybody else with cancer, and I have not given up on God. And one of the Bible verses my 18-year-old daughter shared with me, she actually wanted it as a tattoo, but it's Isaiah 40, verse 12. Who else has held the oceans in his hands? And over and over and over, I've had to remind myself that surely if he holds the oceans, he can hold me, and surely he holds my sister. And I'm just here to tell you that it is entirely possible to not lose your faith in God, even in the midst of crisis. It's entirely possible to know peace in spite of your circumstances. And I believe the only reason for that is prayer. I believe that's the only thing that has gotten me through this year. Sometimes it's your own prayers. Sometimes it's the prayer of the Jesus people on your behalf. But sometimes it's all we have.
Thanks, Cindy. We were on the phone this week, and she said something to me that I feel like is really insightful, and it's just reiterate. She said, AJ, I often think when I show up places, people are like, oh, here comes Cindy. It's going to be heavy. And I thought, man, I just wonder how many in this room at this church feel that. Like, everywhere you go, you can't not feel. Or I guess you can and numb, but you know that if people ask you how you're doing, it's like raw. And this sort of phrase hit me as we move into this next moment that I think Cindy's sort of opening up for us, because stories sort of open stuff up in us. And it's this phrase, edge of grief. I don't know why, but I got off the phone and this phrase, edge of grief, just came into my head. And I just wondered, like, how many of us are here that feel like we're at the edge of our grief? And there's this quiet desperation that Henry David Thoreau talks about. And this morning, you need to be seen, and you need to be surrounded by solidarity, and you need to be touched, because you're carrying this around, and that you need permission, that it's okay for you to carry it. You don't have to hide it and pretend. That why else does the church exist? Are we just here to hear some information, some talks? Or is there somehow a gift of solidarity? Is there somehow a gift of mercy? Is somehow a gift of touch that you can't get in a podcast? That you can't get in other organizations or institutions? That the church was designed to be the people of God, to say your story matters. And I'll stand with you. And I'll do everything I can with the authority God has put in me to channel it towards you and pray for your healing. But know this, I will stand with you at the edge of your grief. And I just want to say, if that is you, I want to invite you to stand. You don't have to come forward. We just want to know who has walked in here that's sitting in front of me, that I had no idea you were walking with this. I want to stand with you. If that's you and you're at the edge of your grief, I just want to invite you to stand up if you'd feel comfortable with that. I'll just give a couple more minutes. This is about noticing. Noticing God by noticing other people. People sitting close to you, people a few rows up, people a few rows back. We come in, we sing the songs, we hope the talk doesn't go too long because there's a brunch waiting for me, I get it. But we're missing the person behind us who needs to be seen and touched. That this is why they're here, and they didn't know it today, but this is why they're here. And here's the thing, for those of us sitting down, this is why you're here. Certainly not to hear me, but to be the church. If you're standing around some of these people, or some of you maybe know someone across the room and you want to run over, we just want to lay hands on you. You don't have to explain your story. There's time for that. You don't have to explain it. We just want to be with you in this moment. So if you're around them, just stand and lay hands if you feel comfortable with that. And I just want to create a minute for everyone just simple prayers of solidarity and touch and presence. So let's just lay hands. If you're around these people, let's just lay hands on them and say, we see you, we touch you, we feel you, we recognize you're here. We choose to continue to be curious about you after this moment, that you are not alone, that we are the church. And this is what the church does. So let's just begin and let's just pray. So just pray out loud all at the same time. That's fine. God can parse it. Spirit groaning within us, we choose to trust that. We don't always feel it or sense it. We choose to know you are in us and that you are working renewal from the core of who we are in our bodies and our character and our decisions. May we yield to you and surrender. I pray for my friends standing right now that they would know that they are loved, that they are seen, that they matter, that they are not a drain, that they are not a problem. God, and I pray that we as a church would be the church, that you would empower us to love, you would empower us to notice and to see. God, do wonderful things in this room. We do not stand against you in your kingdom. We invite it. We need your kingdom. So come and make this place thin. Thin space for your presence to move. Where there's no obstacle, there's no barrier, there's only more and more faith that's being added, giving permission for you to do whatever you want. So we say, come, Lord Jesus, bind our wounds, heal our maladies, give us hope, give us trust. May we be the church in our time, in Grand Rapids as it is in heaven.